You're listening to the Difficulty Adjusted Podcast, the podcast for Bitcoin miners. This show is brought to you by Red Dirt Mining. I'm your host, Storm Rund. All right, so Arceris and Logan, thank you guys so much for joining this episode of Difficulty Adjusted. We decided to record this podcast pretty much in the wake of Jason Lowry's takeover of Twitter last week, sort of around Thanksgiving. And basically, if you've been following that saga at all, we've been seeing how Jason is sort of trying to get this framework of munitions and warfare and soft war and power projection and watts. And this entire litany of terms that has probably confused the hell out of a lot of people into the Bitcoin sphere, and specifically the Bitcoin mining sphere. And I know, Arceris, that you are Bitcoin, you are mining, you're part of one of the partners at Distributed Hash. Logan, I don't know if you're mining right now. When Arceris joined, I could hear some probably S19s humming in the background. I couldn't hear it with you, but you know, I'm sure you've got them back there somewhere. But I just wanted to give you guys a chance to introduce yourself before we dive into this. It's a mess. Before we kind of do some schooling on lawyering and sort of what legal precedent actually looks like, what it doesn't look like. And then introduce an issue that we're all pretty worried about and that we think the Bitcoin community really needs to be start taking seriously and investigate it. So before we get into that, just Logan, why don't we start with you? Just give yourself an introduction.
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for setting this up and thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation. My name is Logan Bollinger. I am a practicing attorney. I graduated from law school in 2018, went to WashU in St. Louis. First few years of my practice were mostly corporate, and now I'm doing mostly civil litigation, workers' compensation stuff. I write a Bitcoin newsletter, I go on Bitcoin podcasts, have lots of Bitcoin conversations. Happy to be here.
Go ahead, Arceris.
All right. So I'm Arceris. I graduated in law school a little bit ago in 2003. My background is patent law primarily, but then I got involved in some First Amendment work. I've done some lobbying for some various groups. Then I got into basically doing corporate law for myself and my wife in a company that we have. Pivoted into Bitcoin mining earlier this year, basically. Been mining for a while, but decided to sort of make it a professional thing. But yeah, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Awesome. So I think let's start with what Jason seems to be arguing here. So Jason seems to be arguing that, similar to PGP, and there was a case in the 90s from a guy named Zimmerman, but PGP, any software that has specifically, quote, military-grade encryption can be sort of interpreted as a non-lethal munition. And thus, assets like Bitcoin with strong encryption probably have some national defense functionality and potentially protections under the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is probably, as Logan has frequently said on Twitter, one of the more misunderstood and flippantly talked about and flippantly used amendments that we have under the Constitution, under the Bill of Rights. So Jason responded to somebody talking about what his argument is, summarizing it by saying, there's a lot of legal precedent for this, noting the use of Second Amendment towards the encryption. And he says, it's very noteworthy that the U.S. isn't acknowledging this when deciding how to regulate Bitcoin. To understand the strategy of your adversary, look at what they're not doing. They're deliberately not framing Bitcoin as anything but money. I think let's just dive into legal precedent. He gives two things when he's talking about legal precedent, and two things to say that there's actually a lot of legal precedent. The first one is a law review article out of Hastings Law School called The Second Amendment and the Struggle Over Cryptography. The second one is a case from the 90s from a plaintiff named Zimmerman, who had a encryption software that he brought up the argument that it could be regulated under the Second Amendment. He might have a Second Amendment right to actually write the software. The case was dropped. It wasn't argued in front of a court. There is no legal opinion on it. You know, let's start, Logan, let's start with you. Why is this case, the Zimmerman case, not actual legal precedent? And when we're going through legal issues, what does legal precedent actually mean?
Yeah, so legal precedent, I think, put most simply, is judges' opinions and statutes. So that's what you're looking for when you're looking for precedent. So the reason that the Zimmerman case, and I haven't been through this, you know, all the details of this, but the reason why it's not precedent is because my understanding is the case was dropped, and so we never actually got to a judge's opinion. And Arceris, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but Jason has actually conceded that. I went back and forth with him on that. So in order for it to be an accurate statement to say there is precedent for Jason's argument, we would need a court case with an opinion from a judge, a federal judge, that is directly on point, that is offering a judicial opinion on the legal issues that Jason is talking about, which, you know, my understanding of the lay of the legal and jurisprudential land is that we do not have that. And the other thing, the law review article, which is just, you know, people, just to kind of give people a sense of how law reviews work. I mean, these are journal publications. Every law school has a law review. And, you know, different scholars and students and faculty members will publish legal articles in those law review journals. They're staffed by students who, you know, spend time deciding what goes in and what doesn't. Generally speaking, the more prestigious the law school, the better the law review journal, the more competition there is to get published by the journal, and you know, the higher regard, you know, you're held in if you're published in those journals. So it matters, you know, what school is publishing the journal, not to get too elitist about it, but that matters. But you know, oftentimes students will, you know, write notes for, or they'll, you know, draft an article for a law review journal, and they're looking for interesting legal issues that are provocative and thought provoking, and issues that they want to make an argument about that might be mostly theoretical or not really, you know, have any grounding necessarily in current case law, but they're kind of just speculating and making a thought provoking argument. And anybody, you know, in law school can kind of do that. But it's not, there's no precedential value to a law review article at all. I mean, it's not an opinion from a judge. It's not a statute. There is, and this is kind of what I was suggesting to Jason, I mean, there's zero precedential value to a law review article. They can be helpful to judges in drafting opinions. You know, if they're offering an interesting take on the cases that are out there, but they in and of themselves have zero precedential value, which I think is, so when Jason says something like, oh, there's a lot of precedent, and he points you to a law review article, it's kind of an oxymoronic exercise, because there's no precedent, you know, to a law review article.
In Arceris, I want to bring you in here because you actually have experience on faculty in legal academia. So, I mean, explain, you know, Logan, I think you did a great job of explaining, you know, why precedential value is important. You know, if you try to tell this to a judge, oftentimes they will say, so what? This is not the law. This is something, I think you pointed out, Logan, that this was a third year out of law school corporate attorney that just happened to have wrote something like this. Maybe they had legal academia aspirations at this specific law school. Who knows? But
yeah, and that author was, you know, he, I mean, I want to give him credit. I mean, he went to, I think he went to Georgetown, I want to say, don't quote me on that, but he was a circuit court clerk, which is a prestigious thing to do. And he probably did harbor some aspirations of, you know, doing something in that field. But you're correct, certainly in saying that, you know, a judge would, if you sort of present as your precedent to a judge, a law review article, he's going to look at you and probably quote the Big Lebowski and say, that's just like your opinion, man. You know, it's not the law.
Yeah. I'll correct you on his law school. Eric Rice, who wrote that article, actually went to Harvard Law School, but still, it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Like you said, he's just a practicing attorney, wrote an interesting article for a law school journal. And like you said, those things are completely non-precedential. They do have value in the sense that if there is a unique area of law and somebody has written on it in one of these journals, a judge will potentially take it into consideration while trying to deal with novel situations that have never been in front of them before, and that where there doesn't exist any precedent. So in that sense, they can provide a lot of value for that, but that's all they are, as guideposts or someone's opinion that who has thought of this deeply. It doesn't mean anything until a judge has actually issued a decision. And even then, as I'm the two of you well know, district court or the trial court's opinion isn't precedential either. It's also guiding it. You really need to get up to an appellate court before you have seriously binding precedent that other courts have to pay attention to.
Arsers, can you actually talk? I think it would be useful for listeners, candidly, if you just spend a little more time on what you just spoke about the sort of district courts versus appellate courts. Just, I don't know if everybody listening has a sense of, district court, appellate court, Supreme Court, and the precedential value or not of decisions from those various courts. I think that'd be
helpful. I think that's super important. Yeah, please do.
Okay. And Ed, please jump in here if you see me straying a little too far. But you have your trial courts. These are your district courts. I'm gonna stick to the federal model because some states can be different, especially with the names. New York, looking at you here. In the federal system, and generally speaking, in most states, it's structured this way, where you have a three tiers of courts. The lowest court, the district court, is where trials are held. That's where the majority of the action is that most citizens might interact with on a reasonable basis. Once a decision or a result is received in a trial court, those judges will issue opinions about various things. Like if they grant a motion to dismiss, which is basically saying to one side or the other, you win without having to go through a trial. And in those motions, in those arguments, they will rely on things like previous precedent, which is other courts' decisions, specifically appellate courts and the Supreme Court. And sometimes if it's a novel thing, they might look to a law review article, cite it, and then do whatever the hell they want. but if you disagree, if a litigant disagrees with how that court has found in that case, they can appeal it. And the first level of appeal in the federal court system is the circuit court. Everybody's probably heard of the Ninth Circuit. Of course, there's many of them. And they cover geographic areas of the country with two exceptions. Then that's the D.C. Circuit and the Federal Circuit. There might be another exception, but those are the two that I'm familiar with. At those levels, you have arguments about whether or not the trial court screwed up. And when the circuit court has issued a decision, it goes back to the trial court, and they have to follow it. That's called precedent, and that's binding precedent, at least for the district court. And if you believe that the circuit court has screwed up, you can appeal again. And there's sort of an intermediate level called en banc, which is we don't really have to get into, but it's kind of a medium level before you go all the way to the Supreme Court. But let's say you get to the Supreme Court. It means you're saying that the circuit court screwed up. And the Supreme Court gets to argue or gets to opine on whether or not they agree with you. And they don't even have to, like, the circuit court appeal, they have to take it. But on the Supreme Court, they can be like, yeah, we don't like you. You're not interesting enough. We're not going to pay attention to you. But if they do take it and they do issue an opinion, then it's binding everywhere in the country and all courts have to follow it. Now, they can that there's caveats on that in the sense that the Supreme Court may not fully flesh out a field, and so there may be marginal areas where people can still make arguments. But by and large, if you are arguing on point with a Supreme Court decision, the lower courts pretty much have to do what the Supreme Court has said. So that's where you get binding precedent, and that's when lawyers say precedent, that's what they mean. They mean that the lowest court must do what the higher courts have said.
I think that was that's an excellent crash course of sort of what precedent means, why it's important, and just to contextualize all of this and why we just put you all through that for if you're listening, to review, Jason gave us, and I want to also give Jason some credit real quick, and I think we were talking about it a little bit before. What Jason does descriptively in talking about sort of these novel ways of conceiving Bitcoin, or sort of talking about it as sort of this, however fuzzy you think it is, with power projection and soft war. I mean, these are novel ways of thinking about Bitcoin, and the way of in which we talk about it is interesting. I enjoy reading Jason's work for that reason, but when he uses these descriptions to then talk about prescribing certain legal strategies onto Bitcoin and people eat them up without actually having any sort of legal education, and then pointed to things like a law review article, which as Logan established is really just an opinion, and then one case from the 90s which didn't actually get argued. So everything that Arceris just gave you as far as the way the court system works and the federal precedent system works, it doesn't belong anywhere in that. That's sort of the trial court, the appeals court, the Supreme Court, and the issues, the opinions they put out. It doesn't exist anywhere in there. So when we get people like my favorite Bitcoin influencer, Dennis Porter, saying, I haven't seen one argument against using the Second Amendment to protect Bitcoin, it's problematic for reasons that, we're going to get into. But, to tease it a little bit, there are unintended consequences of these things. When you apply these frameworks to something like Bitcoin, to something novel like mining, there are downstream effects of all of this stuff. It's not just straightforward as I want more protection. The Second Amendment provides protection for things I like guns. Let's just apply that to Bitcoin, and now all of a sudden nobody can take my Bitcoin like nobody can take my guns. So I think what we need to do is we need to establish some basics of the Second Amendment. Caveat, we are not issuing an opinion about the Second Amendment, about whether or not we believe in the virtues or don't believe in the virtues. We are just trying to educate on what the actual law says. If you get in trouble and you have a case in controversy and you go in front of a judge, what types of arguments are going to fly and what types aren't? Let me give you an example of an argument that won't fly. You get caught with a fully loaded assault rifle in your locker at the gym, and you say, I can have this here because no local regulations apply to me, no state regulations apply to me, because I have the Second Amendment, I have the right to bear arms. That is not how this works. This is not how it's ever going to work, and if you try to tell that to a judge, you are going to lose, and you will probably go to jail. So there are contours to this thing, and there are arguments that fly and there are arguments that don't fly. There are things that the state can do to restrict your right to bear arms, and there are things that the state can do to regulate it and require you to do certain things. So, Logan, I really want you, because this has been an issue that you've made clear to me, drives you crazy, to walk us through some of the basics of how the Second Amendment actually works, what it actually covers, and Arceris, did you want to say something before we get into that?
Oh, yeah. Well, before he jumps into discussing it, let's just read it, to make sure that everybody knows
great
exactly.
Idea. Great idea.
Of course, I had the text in front of me just a second ago. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed, period. And I read the punctuation intentionally.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, there's obviously a reason that Arceris read with sort of grammatical emphasis there. Just to sort of level set a little bit, I think that a common non-lawyer perspective on the Second Amendment, which is what you were kind of alluding to, Storm, was is that people just tend to think that the Second Amendment is just this broad, unqualified protection of your, quote unquote, right to possess pretty much any arm, quote unquote, arm that you can imagine or conceive of, including things like assault rifles and handguns or maybe a rocket launcher or maybe a Bitcoin mining machine or whatever could conceivably, you know, fall under the definition of arms. And that's just simply not true. And I think it's important that just first and foremost, people understand. I mean, some of the comments to my back and forth with Jason on Twitter went, you know, the way of like, oh, well, the Second Amendment doesn't really, you know, it kind of sucks at protecting our rights anyways. And the implication being, well, you know, we should be allowed to have all these other weapons because of the Second Amendment. And so that's just not how the Second Amendment works. There wasn't actually a ton of case law on the Second Amendment until the most kind of seminal case of recent memory would be D.C., a case called D.C. versus Heller. The majority opinion was written by the late Antonin Scalia, and if you know anything about Scalia, the sort of like first 15 pages of the opinion, that's all about the language of the Second Amendment that Arthur's just read for us and what all of that means historically, then, you know, that's pretty classic Scalia. But the D.C. versus Heller case is about a law that D.C. had on the books banning handguns, handgun possession. And I think there was another component of it that was required you to, if you had like a rifle, I think it had to be kept in a certain way, you know, disassembled, I think.
Trigger locks. Something like that.
And so it was challenged. And the issue was basically, does, you know, as Arceus was reading the Second Amendment, the text of the Second Amendment, there's that the sort of initial clause about, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary, yada, 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 comma, you know, the right to keep and bear arms, you know, will not be, you know, limited or abridged. And the issue in D.C. versus Heller was, is the Second Amendment just about protecting arms, possession of arms in relation to militia service, or does it protect the possession of arms with related to things beyond militia service, things like self-defense? I think most people, the first thing they think of when they think of the Second Amendment is they immediately think of self-defense. They think, oh, I should be able to defend myself with whatever gun or you know, arm that I want. But that's a pretty new interpretation of the Second Amendment, at least in terms of you know, federal jurisprudence. And it wasn't really until D.C. versus Heller that we kind of got that in actual precedent, you know, a federal judge's opinion, Supreme Court opinion, saying, yes, you do have a right under the Second Amendment to possess some, not all, types of arms for the purposes of self-defense, in addition to the, you know, the service and militia. But I think most importantly is for people to understand is that even Scalia, who was a conservative justice, he noted at the end of the opinion very clearly and unequivocally that there are limitations to the Second Amendment, that it is not unlimited. I think I have it here, I can read you some verbatim language from Scalia. He says, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. And then he kind of goes through some examples of things, limitations that could be put on the Second Amendment. And like Storm was saying, you know, the Second Amendment, and especially in this opinion, as this opinion makes clear, does not give you the right to just walk around with an AK-47 loaded, or, you know, keep it in your locker at school. I mean, this type of stuff, there are lots of limitations. So I think to kind of just wrap this thought up a little bit and contextualize it, bring it back to what Jason was arguing, is that I think what people, they are attracted to Jason's argument about Second Amendment protection because they associate the Second Amendment with extraordinarily broad protection that it does not actually afford, because they make a mistake in terms of the extent of the protection that's provided by the Second Amendment, when actually it's not quite as much as they, probably not even close to as much as they think. So it's not really this huge victory from a scope of protection standpoint to sort of preemptively argue that, you know, the Second Amendment applies to Bitcoin mining, because as we can maybe talk about a little bit later, per the D.C. v. Heller opinion, I'm not sure that Bitcoin mining falls under some of these definitions that Scalia is looking at. And you know, Scalia loves to look at the dictionaries, like 100 different dictionaries from the time. I'm not sure that the definitions that Scalia is getting at in terms of what an arm is, I'm not sure that the Bitcoin mining machines are going to get in there. So, I'll wrap it there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great view of Heller. And just to give everybody just some examples of reasonable regulations and sort of how you could imagine it applying to Bitcoin mining. Here's some regulations that have held up in court. That actually these are laws that either a state or a municipality have passed to put restrictions on your right to own a gun. Background checks, first one. Laws limiting the sale of certain types of guns or ammo. Age restrictions, location restrictions, restricting sales to individuals who have been sentenced to over a year in prison. That's a case called Booker from the Seventh Circuit. A California law that was upheld to show that individuals have to have good cause to carry for concealed carry, to actually carry a gun out in public. There is a case called Hayes that restrictions on domestic violence convicts owning guns is okay. The state can pass regulations like that. All that is to show, you know, everything. It's really to highlight what Logan said. The Second Amendment is not an unequivocal protection over the right to own guns. And if you are hoping that the Second Amendment protections are afforded to Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, you can expect similar, quote, reasonable regulations, whether or not you think they're reasonable or not, to be applied to mining ASICs, hardware wallets, etc. So, you know, let's tie this all back into encryption. Arceris, I think you've talked a lot about how, you know, all this being said, there is actually some reason to believe why the Second Amendment actually does apply. So we're not saying, because, you know, we're not saying Jason's wrong about sort of applying this Second Amendment framework to Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. What we'll get to is say this is probably ill-advised and comes with a host of downstream effects.
Yeah, and that's the I wanted to jump in there and talk about even Heller specifically. If you look at some of the language inside of Heller, and I'm actually referring to that law journal article here, the definitions of arms specifically includes armor and defense. So a lot of people who opposed this on Twitter were getting wrapped around the axle saying, oh, Lowry's calling Bitcoin a weapon and it's not a weapon. But the Second Amendment doesn't talk about weapons. It talks about arms. And arms includes armor. Armor's not a weapon. It's a defensive technology. So to say that Bitcoin can't qualify under the Second Amendment because it is not a weapon is the wrong approach. And I'm gonna like Storm said, we're gonna get to why it's perhaps ill-advisable for Bitcoin to be pushed under the Second Amendment by the Bitcoin community. That's not to say that it doesn't fit and that the Second Amendment isn't a powerful tool if it's forced upon us. And in that respect, you know, cryptography does have a long history of being treated as a munition. And so if the government insists upon saying that it's a munition and trying to regulate it as an arm, then the Second Amendment is basically the difference between using the Second Amendment as a sword versus a shield, so to speak. Do we want to force them to adopt an arms regime, or do we want to basically bludgeon them with it after they try it? And it may not seem like a big difference, but it actually is, because if we beg for Second Amendment protection, then all of the things that Logan was talking about, all of the things that Storm was talking about, all of the regulations that can apply, you know, automatically do. But you know, if they're going to say, oh, it's a weapon again, and just like we're going to treat it like we did in the 80s and 90s, and you guys don't get any access to it except for these dumbed down versions like the Clipper chip and other things like that, well, then you can make Second Amendment arguments. But you can also make, I mean, as we were discussing before this call started, you can make 4th, 5th, 6th, 9th, and 10th Amendment arguments as well. So the Second Amendment isn't the be-all, end-all either. And, of course, the First Amendment, I shouldn't have left that one out. But I don't believe any of us are saying that his arguments about the Second Amendment applying and what happens is necessarily wrong. It's just the unintended consequences of what happens once you apply it are the big problems here.
Yeah, and can you, I mean, just to give us a little bit more color there too, because, you know, he's not wrong in the colloquial, not the actual legal definition of the word precedent, but he is not wrong in this sort of colloquial sense that there are past examples of somebody trying to argue that cryptography is a munition and ought to be afforded Second Amendment protection. Someone has tried that. If Arsus, do you remember much about the Zimmerman case? Can you share a little bit about it?
Okay, so like we talked earlier, the Zimmerman case was never – it was brought. He was charged, but they dropped it. So right. It's basically a null prosecco, or they dropped the charges. It was never brought to trial. So there was never real testing of the Second Amendment issues. From what I understand historically and from what Lowry has said and from what other sources have said, Zimmerman's attorney was gearing up to make the Second Amendment argument in addition to the First Amendment argument because the government was coming at him using the International Trade in Arms regulations. They were saying it's ammunition. And, well, effectively, that meant his strongest position was, okay, I have this whole First Amendment argument the EFF is making, but I'm going to make the Second Amendment argument because my job as Zimmerman's attorney is to get Zimmerman off, not necessarily worry about the broad strokes here, but make sure that Zimmerman doesn't go to jail. And I have all of these other people making these wonderful First Amendment arguments. I'm going to make the Second Amendment argument that I think is pretty good. And then all of a sudden the government drops the case. We don't know why. They never said. It could be because they got scared of the Second Amendment argument, which is what Lowry strongly insinuates, or it could be because they got scared of the First Amendment arguments, or they could have just done it because they decided they didn't want a deal and that it wasn't worth fighting. You don't really know, but realistically, prosecutors don't drop cases that they think they can win. So it could just be they may not have want precedent to be set, or they just didn't think they were going to win it because you bring a jury in front of it and you see the federal government coming down against somebody who published a little bit of code. It just didn't feel like a good winning argument to them, so they just dropped it. We don't know. So, and that's why this isn't precedential, because there is literally nothing there other than they thought about it and didn't do it. But as far as I'm aware, nobody has actually ever made this argument in a forum that where precedent would apply in any event. So,
but of course, as we're saying, that doesn't mean it doesn't fit. Yeah, and that's part of the reason that brings us here today is that we're worried about the consequences and these downstream consequences that if and when it actually does fit and apply to Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining, that we could see some regulation on the light side and then outright state seizure of hash on perhaps the more extreme side. So I think before we dive into sort of the two avenues that we see that could potentially happen, Arsus, just as a miner, give us a little bit more color on what you could potentially be worried about if, say, let's say the Bitcoin community really rallies around the Second Amendment argument and we proactively try to go out and get Bitcoin classified as an arm with Jason Lowry and Dennis Porter leading the charge. What ought we be worried about?
Well, if Bitcoin generally and mining specifically becomes if it's a munition or an arm, then Bitcoin mining is effectively arms manufacture. Well, those are pretty highly regulated businesses to begin with. So you've got all of the general regulations that attach to an arms manufacturer might apply. And I haven't looked into those, but they're probably not pleasant. You've got national security arguments. What if you're running hash machines that have been developed, built here in the United States? Now are you under some sort of secrecy regime because they're chipsets that are not publicly available around the world, or They are, but our government doesn't really care because, you know, they're not exactly great about that. But then, you know, now you have a military asset that you're dealing with. What if we get into a soft war, the way Lowry talks about it? And once you're in an actual, quote, war, well, now I have military, as a miner, I have military assets. What if the government just wants to seize them for the war effort? That certainly seems a lot more likely than if they're not munitions or not arms in any way.
Yeah. So those are the stakes. Those are the stakes of everything that we're going to be talking about here. So, I mean, that's what we're going to do next is we're going to talk about how this could actually play out and what the real legal precedent is for something like this being able to happen. So there are really two ways that we're going to talk about this potentially taking place, sort of different Genesis stories here. One is the idea of sort of it's the Poli idea, and it's Jeremy Poli, right? Yeah, Jeremy, and you know, we want to give Jeremy some credit here because he had a great thread on this topic of basically the idea. You know, actually, Logan, well, I want you to jump in and just sort of summarize, because you had a chance to talk to Jeremy before you came on, and sort of just summarize what he was concerned about and sort of how we could get to a place where Bitcoin mining actually gets a judicial opinion behind it that says it's a munition, and we could actually wind up triggering all these Second Amendment problems that we just detailed.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do my best, and Storm, certainly jump in if I misstate anything. Shout out to Jeremy Poli. He wrote this thread, and everybody should go read the thread and check it out. And I talked to him a little bit about it. You know, the munitions regimes, the ITAR regs and stuff like that. So that's pretty well outside of my wheelhouse. But Jeremy's concern, you know, if I recall correctly, was that, you know, that if Bitcoin mining sort of gets caught up in all of these sort of international arms regulations, like the ITAR stuff and everything, that, you know, we're just going to have a litany of unforeseen consequences that the Second Amendment is not actually going to protect us from. That was the kind of the part that when we spoke that I agreed with, and because that was a little bit more in my wheelhouse, where I was just kind of, yeah, if the concern here is that we're begging for Second Amendment protection, but we're begging for something that is in, at least in my opinion, and maybe we differ a little bit on this panel, but if we're begging for something that is not actually going to be available to us, then we're kind of asking for trouble and problems, essentially.
Yeah, and one of the ways that I think Jeremy highlights that could potentially happen is he gives the hypothetical of, you know, because the problem is, okay, well, you say this is going to happen, Logan, Storm, and Arceus, but, you know, there's actually no precedent for calling Bitcoin or ASICs or Bitcoin mining munitions in the first place. So he gives the hypothetical of, let's say, a local or county regulation tries to, by using energy FUD or sort of ESG justifications, put some sort of regulation that a miner does not like upon them. And they try to argue, you can't do this because I have Second Amendment protections. Bitcoin ASICs, you know, we use military grade encryption. And there's actually reason to believe, just like the arguments the RSRS put forward with body armor being sort of a self-defense protection, it is an arm and it is regulated under the Second Amendment. I get the protections and you cannot regulate. This is not a reasonable regulation on my arms. That is one way that we could potentially end up in that neighborhood. And then the second avenue that I think we should very deliberately walk through here is this case called Youngstown Steel Seizure. And this is sort of our way of breaking down what it would actually look like if the government wanted to step in and not just regulate, potentially actually take possession of Bitcoin mining operations. So I don't know which one of you wanted to sort of like give us some background of what that Youngstown Steel Seizure case was about and how it applies here. Yeah, go ahead, Arcers.
But before we get into Youngstown Steel, I'll happily cede that to Logan, since I believe he's probably read more about it than I have. I do want to point out on your first component there, Second Amendment, shouldn't give the local municipalities the right to regulate me. Blah blah blah. I'm special. It's the Second Amendment says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't give you the right to operate said arms willy-nilly. You can't go down to your local shopping mall and start hunting for deer, right? So just because you have the right to keep and bear an ASIC doesn't mean you have the right to operate it willy-nilly. So the Second Amendment, like the argument that the Second Amendment would give people the ability to resist these things, and I think those people who are saying that are perhaps a little misguided. Even the First Amendment has reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, and I consider myself a First Amendment absolutist. So in that respect, you don't have all those things. So I think that some of the people who are saying we should do this are, like we were discussing earlier, wildly overinflating the importance of the Second Amendment in this case.
Not being able to hunt for deer at your shopping mall, does Bitcoin fix this? All right, Logan, take us through Youngstown.
Oh, man. Yeah, so sorry, I'm just cracking up at the last comment. But so Youngstown Steel, I imagine that most folks have no idea. You know, I mean, this is one of those things that you spend a lot of time on in law school, that is actually kind of important and that has a lot of reverberations in policy and governing, but that most people don't know. But Youngstown Steel, this is a case from, I believe, I want to say 1952, Supreme Court case. This case was, this happens during the Korean War. And the president at the time, I want to say Truman. So the steel workers, the United Steel Workers Union, went on strike. This is, again, middle of the Korean War. So we have troops, you know, on the ground, and the steel workers go on strike. The president basically thinks to himself, OK, this is a problem, because we need steel. Obviously, we're fighting a war. So this is important to the war effort. And if these workers strike, the factories are going to shut down, and that's going to be a national security issue. And so the president takes it upon himself to basically seize control of these sort of steel plants. And the steel plants, I believe they are the parties who brought the challenge and said, listen, you can't do this. This is beyond the scope of your power, your constitutional power as the executive of the United States. And so the result of the case, the court held, I think 6-3, that this was an overstep on the part of the president, that he did not have the power to do this. The most famous piece of the opinion wasn't actually the majority opinion. It was the concurring opinion by Justice Robert Jackson, who was also famous for, I believe, prosecuting the Nuremberg trials. So Jackson writes this concurring opinion where he basically gives this kind of tripartite sort of structure of when does the president have the most executive power to do something like this? Because as Storm has kind of alluded to, we're trying to think of the downstream effects of, Bitcoin mining being considered sort of like something you would do during war, whether that's a de facto war or a de jure war, like an official war. What powers could be brought to bear either congressionally or from the executive on an industry that was deemed to be integral to a war effort, whether that's a quote unquote soft war, or a hard war, a hot war. And so Justice Jackson, his concurring opinion, kind of lays out a framework, a three-part framework, that I'm sure we'll get into.
So what are sort of the elements? And I want to, we talked about this earlier. I want to go from, and I also want to dispel the word tripartite. Don't be scared of the word tripartite. It just, It just means three parts. So it just means Jackson gives us this framework of looking at executive action in times of war at its lowest ebb, sort of the middle ebb, and then the highest ebb. At the lowest ebb, it means that the president wants to do something and Congress explicitly by legislation says you cannot do that. This is a separation of powers thing. It's the way that our Constitution is structured, and it prevents one branch from getting too much authority over any other branch and sort of dominating the decision making of the country. So the lowest ebb is no congressional authority. Specifically in contradiction to the wishes of Congress. Middle ebb is that Congress is effectively silent on the issue. And then the highest ebb is that Congress explicitly authorizes the types of actions that the president is taking in this scenario. And what that looks like usually is that the executive will take action, some sort of action, and then they'll point to a statute and say, look here, even maybe Congress wasn't thinking about this specific action when they passed this law, but based on the language of the bill, it applies in this situation, and therefore I have explicit authority as the president of the United States to do this. Arcers, what would it look like in the lowest ebb? If we were actually in a hypothetical world where the executive might be operating in the lowest ebb, what would that look like?
Well, so in this case, if Congress passed a law saying that explicitly Bitcoin mining is not ammunition, is not an arm, and it cannot be seized in any way. Like Congress somehow comes out and says all of these things are going to be absolutely protected against seizure by the executive for any reason whatsoever, or you know they could just propound on a lot of different ways. But I do want to point out that just because it's in the weakest point and the Congress has said you can't do this doesn't mean the president can't do it. I mean, if Congress said, the executive passed a law saying the executive is no longer the commander in chief of the armed forces, that they can do that. It won't have any effect because the Constitution says no, the president is the commander in chief of the armed forces. So, but that is the Congress overstepping its authority aside, where they are acting inside of their authority to limit the executive, then the executive power is clearly limited and they cannot and it cannot exercise authority there. So we're talking about some clear or implicit prohibition on the seizure of hash or something like that.
And then, Logan, do you want to take what sort of so the middle ebb is where we would conceivably be sitting at, right? Bitcoiners can rest easy in the fact that there's no explicit congressional authorization to seize hash. Like, there's not an obvious statute on the books that looks like it. So the first place we might actually look is this sort of middle ebb. And what are some examples of middle ebb presidential actions, or just sort of conceptually, what does that look like? And how are some ways that a president may act at the middle ebb to do these sort of national security interests, strategically important decision making, such as seizing steel factories or seizing Bitcoin mining operations for the advancement of software and soft war interests? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think that the middle ebb, at least the way I conceive of it, is basically it can become kind of a morass of people of the executive and then also Congress debating kind of, okay, what clause can each of us respectively invoke to justify, from the president's perspective, to justify what he or she has chosen to do hypothetically, but just to lay out that what it actually is, this sort of middle zone, Justice Jackson refers to it as a zone of twilight between Congress and the executive. I think for good reason, because it's kind of a gray zone of confusion where it's not clear what power the executive would have over certain things in the absence of an explicit congressional authorization. So he would, the executive would, in that case, be able to act, you know, to the extent that his executive powers, as sort of, or as articulated by, you know, Article 2 of the Constitution, he could act sort of to the extent that those powers allow. But, you know, then there's kind of a zone of twilight where if Congress has not kind of explicitly said, well, you can't sort of go past this point, then, you know, there's kind of just some gray area there. And I think what could happen there is you could get, you know, hypothetically, you could have an executive, or we could have an executive who hates Bitcoin mining, you know, doesn't like the energy consumption, or, you know, pick your brand of FUD, and, you know, make some executive order, you know, in the absence of Congress saying, you know, this is not an arm, explicitly. That could, you know, issue an executive order and classify Bitcoin mining kind of however he or she wants. And then what happens, at least what I think would happen, is then you kind of probably have a series of litigation that gets initiated, where we start arguing over what is the authority level of the executive to do this. You know, does it overstep into, you know, something that should be in Congress's domain? And then we just kind of fight about it. And then there'll be a plethora of legal arguments on both sides arguing that, you know, Congress should have the power here, or the executive is overstepping or not overstepping. But then it just becomes a real mess. It becomes a political football, I think, a little bit at that point. And you really don't, I don't think we know going in, or I don't think we can accurately predict how that would turn out. I don't think, you know, I think it depends on environmentally what's going on in the larger macro geopolitical world. If we are literally in a war, then I don't think that, you know, I think it's less likely that the executive, any move that the executive would make in classifying Bitcoin mining as in some way, you know, unfavorably as an arm or something like that. If it's viewed as national security related, and we are in either a de facto or de jure war, I think it's kind of an uphill battle to tell the executive at that point, hey, you can't do this, or you can't classify it this way. I think, as we've seen, there's numerous examples historically of, you know, executives taking action in environments like that, and, you know, them kind of ultimately being, you know, allowed, ratified. That zone of twilight can get kind of generous. Despite the actual result in Youngstown, I think there are plenty of examples of oversteps that get taken during times of perceived emergencies. So I think the middle ebb creates a potential mess.
So I'm a Bitcoiner, I'm a miner, I'm hearing what you're saying. And you know, I don't really believe that Congress is going to be able to do anything. So as I'm hearing this for the first time, I say, okay, I'm looking at the highest ebb, and that means explicit Congress authorization. I don't think we have that. And I'm looking at the lowest ebb, and that means specifically Congress says executive can't do that. Again, I don't think Congress is ever going to pass anything about this, because they're useless. So I feel comfortable that we're in the middle ebb. Give me some hope. I hear you that saying that it's going to be messy no matter what in this middle ebb, but sort of what are the counter arguments? Because we're not in this highest ebb. How might some sort of executive action in this line be found illegitimate while we're in this middle ebb?
I think one way to do it is to explicitly argue that it is not an arm, you know, to basically take the opposite of the Jason Lowry approach. I think the hope is to say exactly the opposite of what Jason Lowry is currently saying. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to Jason Lowry, with all due respect, and I, as a fan of his work generally, from a legal perspective, if you are looking to avoid this potential kind of shit show, for lack of a better word, that this middle ebb could be, I think the way out of it is to say, well, look, you just got it wrong. This is not war material. This is not a war factory. This is not an arm. This is not an arms factory. You know, there's the storm. You've brought up the statute on the books about, you know, ships and ship factories and war materials. I think the argument.
I wanted to save that one to crush everybody's hope.
Well, I guess I'll preemptively try to stir up some hope that you can then just destroy underfoot later. But I think the argument is to just argue that Bitcoin mining is in no way, shape, or form related to war. It's not related to arms. And then I think what you do then is you defang a little bit of some of the executive, you know, emergency powers that can get invoked during times of war. You take away some, but not all, of the bullets in the sort of gun of the executive. So there's, it's not a panacea, but I think you temper things a bit. But go ahead, Arcers.
I did want to point out that after all of this discussion, Justice Jackson, in this tripartite test, he found that Truman's actions were in the bottom of it. So the seizure of the steel mill wasn't even in the second tier of executive action, even back then. He found it to be in the bottom tier. So at least the seminal case in this doesn't even talk about what happened. I mean, they discuss about what it would look like to be in the second tier, but even Jackson said, we are not even in the second tier here. We're in the bottom.
That is a good example for hope. Thank you, Arcers. So let's move into the highest deb. So there are two things that could get us into this highest deb here. One is either Congress passes a new law saying the executive has the authority to do something like seize all Bitcoin mining operations above a megawatt. That is the actual language in a statute. Blah, blah, they dress it up, give it legally sounding language. And then now all of a sudden the executive, whoever it has, they're working in tandem. You have the legislative branch and the executive branch working in tandem to seize Bitcoin mining operations on behalf of the national security apparatus. In that scenario, is there hope?
Yeah, not really. I mean, once you have the authorization to seize property for a military purpose, I mean, we would look toward the Fifth Amendment here, not the Second, because the Second only gives you the right to, you know, keep and bear arms, but it doesn't talk about what happens if the government needs those arms for a war effort. So you look to the Fifth Amendment, which ends with, nor shall private property be taken for public use. Military use is clearly a public use, and there no constitutional scholar would really ever argue otherwise, without just compensation. And so you're starting to look at, you know, they seize your property, and they got to pay you. Well, they're not going to pay you with Bitcoin. They're going to pay you with dollars, and what's just? That's a whole mess right there. So, I mean, yeah, even the most hopeful case of being in the top tier isn't very hopeful.
So, in other words, we're talking about in this scenario where Congress actually passes a new law and they are working in cahoots with the executive branch. The best case scenario we're looking at there is that the Bitcoin mining operations, the civilian-owned Bitcoin mining operations, the core scientifics of the world, the distributed hashes of the world, whoever you happen to be, at whatever level above, let's say, a megawatt, you're getting pennies on the dollar for your operation. You're getting a fraction of what the value of that operation is.
Or you're getting dollars on your sats.
right. Logan, did you want to chime in there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, interestingly enough, it's almost like a backdoor. It's like an iteration of Roosevelt's sort of executive order 6102. Like it kind of, it's just a different version of that that the Bitcoin community hasn't really ever discussed before. I've literally never heard a discussion of this anywhere in Bitcoin. Storm, you're the first person I've ever heard actually bring this whole Youngstown issue up. But yeah, I think there's potential for. If you're in that highest ebb and Congress does authorize executive action, and then the Fifth Amendment comes into play, and then we're basically talking about Executive Order 6102, except instead of gold, it's of your mining machines.
If anything, it's a worse 6102, because, I mean, you could argue that 6102, I mean, I would argue that 6102 wasn't even justified under, I don't think there was a congressional law that gave them the right to do that. They just let it happen. But this, once you're in that highest ebb where Congress has authorized it, then, you know, you really don't have an argument to stop it.
Logan, thank you for bringing up the 6102 point, because that is what started me down this entire path and wanting to get you guys on here, you always hear the obsession with 6102, but, you know, that's, they always use the analogy, people, of fighting the last war. That is the last war of them actually coming after private keys. The modern approach of all of this is this state seizure of hash. And, you know, it doesn't have to be just we're actually going to come in and we find that your Bitcoin mining operations are strategically important infrastructure that need military security. It's going to be more safe with us. This is all for your safety. It could also be, you know, we're going to pass a law that says all American miners need to use Democracy Pool. And it's our own mining pool, and we're going to ensure that there's no financing for terrorist activities or child pornography or anything. And all miners now have to register the hash with this mining pool, so on and so forth, and using all these same legal grounds and justifications that are here. All that's trying to say is 6102 is a red herring. What we're talking about here, this is where the real legal ground sits. And if you're still sitting there saying, well, I hear you saying this doomsday scenario for the highest ebb where there's a new law passed by Congress and they're working in cahoots with the executive, but I'm firm in my belief that Congress is not going to pass anything new. Well, do we have news for you? Because there is a statute out there on the books, and it's Title 50, USC Section 82, and it is the procurement of ships and material during wartime. Arcer, so I talked a little bit about this, but now I've been talking for a second, and I'd love you to just sort of jump in and say how the hell this applies and why we should be concerned about it.
Well, it may not at first sound like it applies, like you said, procurement of ships and material during war. And somebody may step, oh, you mean boats and vessels, submarines, all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, but it also goes on to say, the words war material shall include arms, armament, ammunition, stores, supplies, and equipment for ships and airplanes, and everything required for in connection with the production thereof. And then it got further, factory shall include any factory, workshop, engine works being used for the manufacture, assembling, or construction, or any process, any shipyard or dockyard. Basically, arms and the way of making it.
I want to highlight something there in the definition of factory. Let's just include ellipses around the things. Building used for ... any purpose, any process.
Yeah.
That is the definition of a factory. So if you're saying, well, it's not really a factory, it's not really doing anything, is it a building? Is your hash hut a building? Okay, your hash hut's a building. Is there any process going on there? Yeah, it's there. You're hashing. That's a process. Therefore, you're a factory under this bill.
Once you have ceded the ground that Bitcoin is an arm under Second Amendment, now clearly it's an arm that would be qualified under war material and hence could be used. This already existing law pretty much clearly applies to me.
Yeah. And you know, the way the statute, so we still have the option here of what Logan said. We can take the Jason Lowry doppelganger approach. We can say Bitcoin is by no means munition. The encryption algorithm that it uses is by somehow exempt from the way that we currently define munitions. We're going to go all the way in the other direction and say, no, none of this applies to Bitcoin or Bitcoin mining. I still think there is an argument here that, because basically, there's four parts on subsection B of this law, and I'll put it in the show notes. So if you're curious, anybody, you can go look up the actual text of the law. So there's part A, which gives you your definitions, and then part B that says, in time of war, the president is authorized and empowered, in addition to all other existing provisions of law, to do these four things. In the first three, it talks about war material and the procurement of war material. The definition of war material is shall include arms, armament, ammunition, stores, supplies, and equipment for ships and airplanes, and everything required for or in connection with the production thereof. So there's the big, wide, broad language that could be ASICs and the facilities and rack space and all your electrical infrastructure and everything that goes along with that. You can see immediately the Jason Lowry trap, the arms, armament, ammunition, store supplies, etc. Yeah, go ahead, Arcers.
I was just saying, it's a loophole big enough to drive an Ethereum node through.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's that big, but you know, it's a pretty big loophole. So you might find some solace in the anti-Jason Lowry approach in the war material definition, but unfortunately, under the fourth part of subsection B, the war material definition is completely absent. And it reads, in time of war, the president is authorized and empowered, in addition to all their existing provisions of law, to requisition and take over for use or operation by the government any factory, which we already defined as a building that engages in a process, or any part thereof without taking possession of the entire factory, whether the United States has or has not any contract or agreement with the owner or occupier of such factory. So if I'm a government attorney, I'm going to say, Logan, it doesn't matter if it's an arms or a munition or anything. That's totally irrelevant. We have this statute on the books that says exactly what I just said. Do you find any sort of flaws in that? Almost certainly that's what would be argued in this case. But yeah, I'm just curious, again, give us some hope.
I mean, I guess one way to think about this is, I think so much of the law is definitions, right? So I think you maybe find less willingness to stretch these admittedly very stretchable definitions in ways that to sort of, you know, come at Bitcoin mining, if Bitcoin mining is not perceived as an instrument of some type of you know, a geopolitical software. So if you basically take down the temperature or you lower the stakes of the conversation around Bitcoin mining and you take it out of that sort of war context, I think there's less, because we also, you know, there is the line in the statute about, you know, it says B in section B, in time of war, the president is authorized and empowered, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you for noting that piece.
Yeah. So if we just basically, you know, just stop doing the whole, like, this is an instrument for war and power projection and all that stuff, and we stop doing that, then I think there's, you know, potentially some hope. But I do think, I do want to say, I talk about this every once in a while on Twitter, and I always get some heat for it. I actually just had a tweet earlier today that some people are yelling at me about, where I was just talking about how, you know, it's important to not necessarily have 100% certainty about something, because you should always have a level of intellectual honesty and reflection and sort of be looking for criticisms that are valid, et cetera, et cetera. Well, stuff that I don't think is controversial, but, you know, somebody from a pretty prominent, you know, Bitcoin company who I like, you know, just responds with the quote, "Bitcoin has already won." And my response to that is, and this is like an hour ago, and as we've just been discussing here, no, it has not already won, because it has not even actually fought the battle yet. Like, you know, the battle has not happened yet. We have not entered, and there are so many different ways that it could go. And I think that's why paying attention to some of these unintended consequences, you could create a situation where it is difficult for Bitcoin to win. You could conceive in your mind, you could say, it makes logical sense for me that, you know, Bitcoin is the soundest money ever, all that, which is all true, you know, and, you know, it's already won, it's going to be, we're going to hyper Bitcoinize world, yada, 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 that's just inevitable. But I think people forget, and I said this on What Bitcoin Did, and again, got some shit for it, but I think people forget that a lot of people think a lot of things are inevitable. And there are a lot of variables that people don't think about. You know, I hope we're bringing up some of them now, bringing them to the table to be considered. But people also forget that, you know, Marxists for 150 years, 200 years have said, listen, there's a really logical way that history goes, right? You know, you start with feudalism, you know, people get sick of that, and then you get capitalism, and then, you know, the workers eventually realize this sucks, and, you know, they you know, build a worker state, socialism, and you come, and it's inevitable, right? You know, like Hillary Clinton was inevitable, right? Like, it's like, there's just so many things that are inevitable that seem to follow these logical processes. But there's so many variables, so many unknown unknowns. I hate quoting Donald Rumsfeld, but, you know, it is what it is. Unknown unknowns out there that I do think we need to pay attention to. I think there's certainly hope that Bitcoin mining can avoid some of this, but I do think the Bitcoin community underestimates some of these potential scenarios. And I think they underestimate as sort of sloppy and kind of incompetent and kind of a mess as the state can be at times. I do think they underestimate some of the tools constitutionally and legally speaking that are at the disposal of the state and, you know, arms of the state, that, you know, hopefully we're shedding some light on those here today.
Yeah. And to echo some of the things that you said, I like the Donald Rumsfeld quote, actually. And it reminds me of that Mark Twain, I believe it was Mark Twain quote, that says, it's not what you don't know that'll hurt you. It's what you absolutely know that just ain't so. I think it's a prescient quote. And then I also want to say one thing about certainty and 100% certainty. And I've been a bit of a doomer on this podcast so far. And you know, part of the reason is because I haven't seen anybody talk about this. And the more I look at it and having this conversation with you guys, the more it concerns me, frankly. I think this is a very, very serious issue. And, you know, like you're saying, we haven't seen the battle yet. These tools, as you're seeing, are grounded in pretty solid, highly precedential. Remember what that means, case law. I mean, there are Supreme Court cases on the book that are looking at this. But all of that to say, that doesn't mean this is definitely going to happen. It doesn't mean if you're a Bitcoin mining operator, you should sell out tomorrow and then wait for the doomsday. This could come in 20 years from now. It could never come. It doesn't mean it's coming in the next 2 years or 5 years. But what we're trying to get out here is that this is an under-talked about issue that people need to start taking seriously. Go ahead.
I wanted to also jump on that and also say that to the extent that Jason Lowry is doing work that is pointing at this Second Amendment aspect of Bitcoin mining, that's useful, because who knows what's going to happen over the course of the next 20 years. We might need this. I think all of us here are in agreement that we don't want to be thrown into that briar patch now by our own hand. But if it comes to that, then we do have. He has done some work, and we can use this tool. But also, one thing that I think he's kind of doing us a disservice of is by everybody now arguing over, is it the First Amendment or is it the Second Amendment? They're ignoring that that cryptography has impacts on the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Ninth, Tenth, and as we discussed earlier, possibly even the Third Amendment. So there's all of these other avenues that cryptography touches that that are so important that we shouldn't just focus on these two. I mean, for instance, if the government had the ability to decrypt all of your emails, would that be basically providing evidence against yourself, like in the Fifth Amendment context, or being insecure in your papers and effects under the Fourth Amendment for search and seizure? So. It's not a First Amendment only question, and so people saying, "Oh, it's already been solved under the First Amendment." No, it hasn't. It's the First Amendment plays a huge role. So does the Second. So do the others. We need to make sure that we take all these tools in concert.
Yeah, and Logan, well, go ahead. I mean, if you want to add something onto that.
No, I was just going to say, well said, Arcerus. I agree with all of that.
Well, you know, we've been going for about an hour 15 now. First of all, I want to say thank you guys. I mean, this has been a great conversation. I think this is, a very important conversation for people to start tuning into, and hopefully it'll, you know, sort of spark a larger discussion online. I don't know if either of you guys have any closing words or anything that, maybe we didn't touch on that you might want to circle back to, or, either of you just want to sort of tie a nice bow on everything that we've been talking about.
Sure. I'll just say, well, first of all, I want to say shout out to you, Storm. First of all, you know, you had a tweet. It was, I guess, a week or two ago now. You know, you brought up this Youngstown issue, you know, and potential for, you know, seizure of mining facilities and sort of legal grounding for that. You know, you found that statute as well. I think it's all really, really useful stuff, really good finds and really intelligent, insightful takes. So I appreciate you doing that and putting those thoughts out there, which has kind of helped enable us to have this discussion today. And then I guess the last thing I'll say is, I hope that this conversation leaves people just, you know, more aware of some of these unintended consequences that we're talking about with respect to, you know, Bitcoin mining and the Second Amendment. Hopefully, you know, people are a little bit more in touch with, you know, the the kind of labyrinth of different ways that the Constitution can be used to invoke different powers that we probably haven't thought about. There are probably plenty of powers that we still haven't discussed today that could be brought to bear upon Bitcoin mining potentially unfavorably down the road. And I think my big takeaway from this conversation is we really need to stay alert. We need to stay vigilant about all of these potential legal issues surrounding Bitcoin mining. I think we need more lawyers in Bitcoin and Bitcoiner lawyers. So I want to make a plug for lawyers who are Bitcoiners to be continuing to think about these things and talking about them publicly and getting them out on the table so that we can prepare for them or address them and sort of be equipped to deal with them if and when they arise.
Yeah, well said, Narcissus. You got some last words for us?
Oh yeah, that's all great. I love these discussions. It reminds me of being in law school and thinking about these issues in a less important environment than actually having a case in front of you where things matter, because dealing with these issues before they become a problem and before you're forced to deal with them is actually the way to go. And I think that Bitcoiners sort of mooting out these adversarial setups is one of the strongest parts of the community, and that's we need to keep doing this. And we need to make sure that every time something like this happens, we do have these in-depth discussions, because that's how we continue to make the system stronger.
Awesome. Well, guys, I'd be lying if I said I'm not looking forward to the next sort of hot button legal issue in sort of this vein to happen, so we can hop on and do this again. I want to thank everybody for listening and bearing with us. We know that the minutia of understanding how some aspects of the legal system work can be tedious. Basically, really what we wanted to do today was educate. And we hope that you learned something listening to us. And we really hope that you'll start talking with people around you. If you're on Twitter, give us all a follow. Logan's, you can find him at Logan Bollinger. You can find Arsers at Arsers BTC. And you can find me at _BTC Storm. Find us. Everybody's handles will be in the show notes. We'll put the statutes and everything for you to do a little bit more research for yourself. Maybe you find an argument that we didn't think of. But thank you very much for tuning in, and hopefully we'll see you next time.